Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Philosophy. This week, Dan Lynch joins me. We're going to talk about HPCC systems for high-performance computing. If you have big data, you're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Dan Lynch. Episode 228, recorded October 3rd, 2012. HPCC Systems. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, Libre, open-source software. I'm your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at StoneEngine.com, coming to you each week or as often as I can get here. The movers, the shakers, the big projects, the small projects, the projects you probably heard all about, the projects you might not know anything about, like maybe today's project. But before we get started, let's go ahead and bring on our co-host, Dan Lynch. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks very much. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Very cool. And if I look a little bit this time, it's because I'm speaking to you from New Orleans. And in New Orleans, we do things differently. Like, we don't have our big mic to talk in. I have this little portable headset I'm speaking to. So if I sound a little bit differently, it's because of that. I've got a really bad connection here. So perhaps during the show, you might hear some dropouts from me. I'm really sorry about that, but this is the best I could do. My little Clearwire card wouldn't work here. So I'm relying on the hotel Wi-Fi, which is really sucky, but hopefully it'll hold in for most of it. It probably even dropped out right while I was talking about this. What a deal. Dan, we've got a real interesting guest today. We've got Dr. Flavio Villanustri. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. He's going to talk to us about HPCC systems, which is high-performance computing. So this is the people that have to process big data, crunch stuff in and out, and do the map-reduce operations and data queries. This is the kind of thing you would use if you're searching through a lot of data. And it looks like Dr. Villanustri has got a huge history, a real long history in open source, so we've got to talk to him a little bit about that. What do you know about this so far, Dan?
Only what I've been researching in the last couple of days, I've got to be honest. But it looks really interesting. Obviously, big data is a bit of a buzzword right now. But basically, if you've got like petabytes of data or more, and you need to analyze them, you need some kind of system that's going to be able to handle that. And a lot of systems can't. And that's what they're trying to deal with. So I'm really interested. I don't have quite that much data. My DVD collection's not that big. I don't know what else I could use for that kind of data. But maybe a book collection, I don't know. But it sounds fascinating, and I can't wait to hear more about it.
Maybe I could just index my spam. I know I've got enough big data there.
Yeah.
Tons of spam. Well, I think, well, without further ado, let's go ahead and bring on our guests. I hope I'm pronouncing this right. Dr. Flavio Villanustri, welcome to the show.
That is correct. Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me.
Very good. And where are you speaking to us from?
I'm in Atlanta, Georgia.
Oh, you're just down the street. I'm in New Orleans. So can you see me wave? No, just kidding. It's a little further away than that.
Oh yeah, I can see you.
All good.
He's got big
All
hands.
Good. Yeah. So I introduced HPCC systems at the beginning of the show, but probably did a horrible job of it. Let's hear it directly from the expert. Can you give us the overview of what we're going to be talking about today?
Absolutely. HPCC systems is a platform for data-intensive computing. It has been released under an open source license last year, but it has been developed and used over the last 12 or 13 years by LexisNexis Resolutions. LexisNexis, I don't know if you know much about the company. It is not the car manufacturer, so if you have a Lexus, that didn't come from us. But we do data-intensive computing and provide data solutions and data services, mostly US-focused, but we have some also footprint internationally as well.
LexisNexis is there's some sort of data search service, like searching for legal records or news records or something. Is that the same company?
Well, that is there are two companies called LexisNexis within the same group. We are both owned by Reed Elsevier, a worldwide publisher of books, exhibitions, and research papers and patents and other businesses. The LexisNexis that does the legal, the case law analytics and all the news information is our sister company. They also use the platform across their entire editorial system for case law, where they do the heavy analytics. But the unit that I mean, the LexisNexis Resolutions unit, is about information about identities and risk and fraud. Essentially, we provide services to a large number of corporate customers in the U.S. This is many, many thousand customers. And they use our services to assess risk, for example, for financial transactions or law enforcement or many other verticals, healthcare and legal and others.
Okay, so what's the software we're talking about? It's big data. That's a nice buzzword, but can you sort of describe the kinds of problems that you're solving with this kind of software?
Absolutely. When we started about 13 or 15 years ago, we were using traditional solutions, essentially RDBMS systems and traditional application servers of the time. But many of the analytics that we do on data and also the size of the data weren't necessarily at the sweet spot for those type of platforms. So it didn't really scale for us. Some of the processes that we do are quite complex. Many of them required a machine learning type of process, including clustering analysis and others. And no traditional solutions could be up for the challenge. So we decided to build our own platform. At the time, this is back in 1999 or so, we thought that using a divide and conquer type of approach, where we could segment the data across multiple commodity nodes and process this data, if we could, as much as possible locally on the nodes by moving the algorithm to where the data resides, it could be a lot more functional and a lot more performing than the traditional solutions that are mostly centralized. So based on this type of premise, we came up with our own platform. To put it in perspective, other platforms that do this, like, for example, Hadoop and other open source solutions, didn't come up until much later. It wasn't until 2004, December of 2004, where two Google researchers came up with a paper on distributed computing using MapReduce paradigm. So this came several years earlier. Now, we were very protective of this solution because it is what we do. It is the core of our business and our competitive advantage. But just a couple years ago or 3 years ago, we started discussing the possibility of open sourcing it. And open sourcing it to gather adoption, to foster a more widespread use of the platform, look for new use cases, and essentially get the all the benefits that you get from an open source community, the ability to share development, the ability to apply this platform in problems that are not necessarily equivalent to what we do. And to put it in a little bit of a context, there are two components to this platform. There is a component that does massive data analytics, batch-oriented, mostly single or dual queue type of system. So you have one process at a time. This process does all the data profiling, normalization, standardization, data linking. And when I say data linking, I am talking about inverse document frequency type of linking, not necessarily exact matching, which is something that you could do with any other solution, essentially. And then another component, which is a real-time delivery system that provides for all the real-time access. These two systems are based on the same exact platform. They use share-nothing architectures, so they use commodity nodes running Linux, and we support a number of different Linux distributions, including Red Hat, CentOS, SUSE, Debian, Ubuntu, and others. And they both have the same type of paradigm where data is segmented across the nodes and the process runs across the nodes by moving the algorithms to where the data resides. Of course, there are moments where you need to move data across the nodes. For example, when you do a large sort, a distributed sort across the system. But we try to avoid data moves as much as possible. The network interconnect is just IP-based, so any IP network, Ethernet or IP over InfiniBand will work.
So, Flavio, you mentioned Hadoop there, which wasn't around, you were saying, at the time when you were building this, but I was just doing some research on your website earlier today, and I noticed there's a big banner that advertises Hadoop integration. So can you tell us a little bit about that? How does that work?
That works by allowing HPCC to get data from HDFS file systems and store data back into HDFS file systems. We think that there is a benefit for those using Hadoop currently from leveraging some of the capabilities in HPCC that might not be readily available in Hadoop. So by being able to access the data and the format it is from the HDFS file system itself, we essentially avoid the need to have an external landing zone to move your big data files into it to be able to then load them back into HPCC. So essentially saves time and makes for a more transparent data access across these two systems. So essentially HDFS read and write access from within HPCC for people using HDFS for their main data stores.
Yeah, cool. And I'm curious to know, how does this scale? I mean, you mentioned the fact that you're using a lot of nodes there with the share nothing principle. So I imagine you can just spin up extra nodes and so on. But how does this scale? And what's your kind of biggest installation maybe that you're using right now or that you know of?
Well, I think the bigger customer is ourselves. We have between 5,000 and 35,000 nodes across our data centers. But of course, not in a single cluster. I didn't mention it, but HPCC has the ability to do remote reads from other clusters. So our larger cluster, and this, again, depends on the type of application that you have. But in our case, it's about 400 nodes. But as you can imagine, 25,000 nodes means that we have many of these clusters distributed across the different data centers. The two platforms that I mentioned, the one for backend processing and the one for real-time highly concurrent data delivery, are normally sized equivalently, although the backend platform tends to have more nodes, and this is because you normally need more capacity on the backend as you are doing a lot of data processing with intermediate results. And the frontend system just needs the index data ready to be delivered. What I didn't mention before, and I think this is important, is the fact that when we decided to build this, the design time, we were looking for a viable programming language, something that would allow us to do all these data transformations and data queries. Now, the only language that we had at hand was SQL, and SQL is kind of okay when you're doing data queries, but it's not easy to express data transformations unless you get into custom flavors of SQL. And even then, SQL doesn't allow very well for data and code encapsulation or code easy code reuse and other things. So we decided to build our own high-level programming language. It's a data flow-oriented language called ECL, Enterprise Control Language. And this language is available on both sides, on the backend system on Thor, which is the backend massive parallel system, and also on the front-end real-time delivery system called Roxy. So ECL is the language that allows you to define a data workflow on Thor and also define a data query, a parameterized data query on Roxy.
So I'm curious to know more about ECL then. So if I've done a lot of traditional kind of database stuff with SQL and so on. So how difficult would it be for me to transfer skills? Are the similarities between the two languages, or is it going to be like a whole new learning process for me?
No, it is not a whole new learning process. ECL, same as SQL, is a declarative paradigm. So you tell the system what needs to be done rather than how to do it. And I know I'm also a control freak. I programmed in imperative language my life, so including Perl. I know that there may be some learning curve there to change the way you think and let the system decide to optimize the code in the best way, as long as you can express the type of results that you're expecting. Like in SQL, when you say select these values or these columns from these tables where there is some type of pattern, well, in ECL you do something very similar. In a filter statement, in this case, it would be just the data set name and parentheses with the filter specific filter that you want to apply. So it is quite equivalent to SQL. Now, it is a lot more powerful. ECL it avoids, for example, side effects, so you can very easily do code reuse without the fear calling a function that might return a different result, not based on the parameters that you're passing, but on some other global value stored magically somewhere. It also provides for data and code encapsulation. So you build new functions on ECL that either encapsulate code or code and data, and you can call those functions later on. So to have
essentially well-defined interfaces. And you can change the details of the implementation of those functions later, as long as you maintain the interfaces, and your main processes will still work fine. And again, without side effects, it's easy to document and reuse those functions across a team. We have also a number of other advanced capabilities, including, for example, the fact that we do lazy evaluation. And you probably are familiar with this from languages like Haskell and other functional languages, where things that don't need to be evaluated because they don't have any impact on the end result are not evaluated by default. And the optimizer is... make sure that this happens. Just by the way, the core platform developers from this platform for the last 12 or 13 years used to be originally the developers that developed Turbo Pascal from Borland. So you get an idea where they're coming from, especially compiler developers.
Right, excellent. I was just curious, is there a command line interface for this so I could do some queries to just test them out ad hoc, or is it always through some kind of interface through a language as well?
Yeah, absolutely. There is a command line interface and there is an API. On Thor, we have a web service type of interface where you can submit your own queries, even semi-interactive queries, with the reservation that Thor will do one at a time, of course, or two at a time if you have two queues. On Roxy, of course, the same way, on web service interfaces, and you can run essentially as many as the system will scale to, and this is tens of thousands of queries simultaneously, depending on the number of nodes and the complexity of the queries. Obviously, there is an IDE, and we have an ECL module for Eclipse. So if you're familiar with Eclipse and you like Eclipse, that's a good option. Mm-hmm. And we have our own ECL IDE that we used over the years. We are trying to move to the Eclipse IDE as the final and future-proof IDE. But in the meantime, we have both options available. In addition to the web service interface, we have also JSON and JDBC interfaces. And on the web services side, we have full SOAP with WSDL interfaces and RESTful interfaces on the system. So there are a variety of ways to access the system in a programmatic way without needing to use any IDE. But you could use IDEs as well.
Right. Okay. Excellent. And I'm curious to know if anybody else uses this language. Is it, how close is it tied to the company and the platform? So is it under an open license? Do you know of other projects that use it? Would it be useful to other people, or is it strictly kind of a thing that's mainly used by you guys?
The idea behind the open source project, as I said before, was to foster widespread adoption of the platform and the language. So we released the language under a Creative Commons license. And the entire platform was released under a GPL license, which we are moving now to Apache for the release 3.10, which is upcoming in the next month or so. So both are essentially able to be forked and implemented across other environments. I'm not aware of ECL being implemented across any other environments, but that's a possibility, certainly. Anyone could take ECL and now, based on the specifications and the documentation that is under the Creative Commons license, they could re-implement it for some other platform.
Hmm. And what you mentioned briefly there, that you're moving from a GPL license to Apache. So what's the thinking behind that? Is there some reason why you need to use a permissive license, or you feel there'll be a benefit to that?
Well, initially, and this probably comes from my own history, I've been a proponent for open source for the last, I don't know, 15 years or more. I founded the Buenos Aires Linux User Group back in 1994, so you get the idea for how long. But I've been always quite versed in GPL, and I always liked the idea that they give the control to the end user. Essentially, the end user can request to get all the source code for the application that the end user is using or getting, and they have the entitled to that source code. So I think it's a nice way to ensure that the software remains free, and not free of charge. It's free as giving you freedom. But on the other hand, it imposes restrictions on companies. Companies that are trying to fork the code or commercialize the code in some way, if they are applying extensions to the code or providing services on the code, they may be forced, or linking to the code, forced to release their own proprietary code as well under the same license. On one side, it gives a lot of freedom to the end user, but on the other side, it restricts the freedom from the companies trying to use it. Since this software is mostly a software that corporate entities would use more than individual users, because this is about big data, and there are not that many individual users that might want to process their CD or video collection on HPCC. So I think an Apache license is more attractive, and that's why we made the move over the last couple of months.
Okay, cool. And you mentioned there that the there's a difference between the different kind of editions. So what are the main differences between the different editions of the platform that you've got, or the different editions of the software, I should say?
Well, I mentioned that there are two components. A component that is a backend, a massive data analytics platform and data cleansing and hygiene, all the normalization, standardization, which is called Thor. Thor is the name of the Nordic god of thunder, the one with the big hammer. We say that the hammer is to submit, to hammer data into submission, to make sure that the data will obey your will. And this is a mostly single-threaded platform. It is extremely high-performing. I didn't mention it before, but ECL is compiled to C++ and to machine code as you submit the ECL transformation or ECL query. So when you submit your program on the fly, ECL gets obviously goes through the optimizer, which looks for what you are trying to accomplish and builds the best execution plan. And it compiles it to C++ and machine code. The execution plan is displayed back on a web interface to you, if you want to look at it, in a graphical manner. So it's a number of boxes that depict the activities that you're asking the system to perform, and group them in subgraphs. And those subgraphs are built in a way that they allow for all these activities to be parallelized. Now, these graphs, execution plans, are dynamic. As data traverses the execution plans, the numbers in the edges reflect the number of records that went through, and also the data skews across the nodes. How many more records does the node with the largest number of records have versus the average, and how many less records does the node with the least number of records have versus the average, which is very useful when you're trying to optimize algorithms. And an important feature is that many of the algorithms that we built, like, for example, the global sort, are very well thought, trying to avoid data skews. Data skews in a system that is distributed, where the system will be as slow as the slowest node, it is important to ensure that all the nodes get about the similar number of records to process. And avoiding data skews, and sort is one of the cases, is key. In other systems, you may see people using, for a distributed sort, a radix sort, for example, which will work very well if your data is evenly distributed across the key space that you are using for that distribution. But it doesn't work if you have, for example, a phone book data, and if you are sorting by the last name. In the U.S., you may have a lot of names, last names starting with A's and B's, but I don't think you will have too many names starting with X's, for example. So if you have 26 nodes, the node with the X's will have only a few records versus the node with the A's and B's and C's, which have a lot of records. So sort, for example, will compute a histogram of distribution across the main key or the main keys, and then it will decide which nodes should receive the particular pieces of the key space, the partitions, in order to ensure that you have an even distribution across the node, so each node receives an about the same number of records. On the Roxy side, most of the benefits are around the high availability and the performance, of course, of the system. The fact that Roxy has a share nothing architecture and has no single point of failure, and every node is able to essentially perform the function independently from the others, means that you can rely on the system. And as long as you provide for enough copies of the data and you define what this ratio is, you may lose a lot of nodes and still have a system fully functional, which is key for our business. I didn't say it before, but our Lexis resolution business specifically is about $1.5 billion in revenue on an annual basis. And 100% of this revenue comes from systems that are relying on this platform. So high availability, and they are online services. So high availability is key for our own operation.
And that leads us quite nicely into what's the kind of split between, you mentioned that you could install this yourself, you get the software and install it. So how many say customers would want to run the system themselves, and how many will come to you and just have you host it for them? What's the kind of split like on that?
That is a hard question. Of course, we provide a lot of data services. So many customers that also require data that we have might prefer to host the system with us or provide or have some sort of service on the system rather than host it themselves. But there are many cases, and this is either because customers try to do data processing that has nothing to do with the data that we handle, or because their data is too sensitive to be moved around and they don't want to get it off their offices or their data center. Or because they are completely out of the U.S., so they are not U.S.-based, they wouldn't leverage at all the data that we have, but they do need to have a system of this type to do their own data processing.
Okay, so that leads us quite nicely into the next question, which is, I was wondering, you can get the software and host it yourself, or you can get it hosted by yourselves as a service. So what's the kind of differential like between people who want to run it themselves and people who want to get a hosted solution maybe from yourselves?
There are a few different variables there, and one of those is the fact that we have a substantial amount of data that some customers might be able to leverage. If that's the case, in order to prevent moving the data around, they might want to have us host a service for them, so we can host an HPCC and add our data centers. But in many other cases, there are customers that either because they can't move their data around and they want to process their own data, and or because they wouldn't leverage our data at all, maybe customers that are not even US-based, and since our data is majority US-based, they might just want to run the platform on their own, or because they are tackling a problem that is completely outside of the type of problem that we normally tackle. And there are a number of these customers that are using HPCC for areas that we wouldn't even imagine before. So open source was a very positive experience for us.
So you mentioned earlier that it runs on Linux systems. You can get it for, say, Debian, CentOS, all those kind of systems. And since we're talking a little bit about kind of running it yourself, what's the kind of deployment like for this? Do I take like a stock CentOS server and install extra packages from a repository, or do I get a distribution from yourselves and do it that way? How would I actually deploy this if I wanted to?
Well, there are a couple different options, and you could essentially go to GitHub and download the entire source code and compile it yourself, although I wouldn't recommend that you do that because it's hard or might require some additional work that is not necessarily needed. Or you can go to our portal and download the binary packages. We have RPMs if you have a CentOS distribution for CentOS and Red Hat. We have obviously dev packages for Ubuntu and Debian and RPMs also for SUSE. So you can just download the specific RPMs and deploy them across your distribution. As long as it's reasonably current, again, this is around CentOS 5 or 6 or the equivalent modern versions of Debian and Ubuntu and SUSE, it will work out of the box. Essentially, you deploy the package on the main node, and then we provide all the scripting and tooling to be able to redeploy that across all the other nodes. You need to provide as much as a pre-shared key, SSH keys for this deployment, and everything else is done by the tools that we include.
Excellent. That sounds really good.
I didn't mention that. And I think this is also important. If you didn't have the hardware to run it, but you still want to do some testing, you can also download the VMs. We have some virtual machines available, and you can run the virtual machines in any environment. The same exact ECL code that you ran, and I wasn't explicit on this one. The same ECL code that you run on a virtual machine will run in one node, will run in 10 nodes, in 1,000 nodes. The fact that the ECL language abstracts parallelism means that you don't care really where it's running right now or where you will run it later. Of course, the larger the system, the more space you have for data and the faster it will run, as long as the size of the data problem is big. But the ECL code needs no modifications to scale across any number of nodes.
Now, obviously, I'm a huge Linux fan. Everybody who listens to this show or watches this show will know that. And I was reading in your biography that, since we've been talking a little bit about Linux and so on, that you actually were the founder of the first Linux user group in Buenos Aires back in 1994. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Of course. Hey, I still remember my first incursions in Linux back in 1990 or so. I was I was already a Unix user of some flavors, including SEO and others. And I know that SEO now it's gone, but at that time it was kind of used, and another semi Unix like Xenix and AT&T Unix as well, and I was also looking and using some Minix, and I saw a posting from Linus Torvalds back in the day. This is like 1990 or 1991. I don't even remember now exactly. And I got interested suddenly on someone that from Finland was trying to develop this little kind of toy operating system. Mm-hmm. And I started looking into it. And by 1993, I think I was already using version 0.94 of the kernel. And I think SLS, wasn't that a soft landing system or so, the first distribution on Linux? And then Slackware quickly followed. And by early 1994, I co-founded the Buenos Aires Linux group with another person, and we ran it for a few years, and it was very successful. We got but several other people interested in Linux, and made it a little bit more popular at the time. And at the time, it was a lot harder than now to make it popular. Now you can say Linux in the streets, and almost anyone will know what you are talking about. At that time, people will even not understand what you are referring to.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, so what distributions do you use today? You still a big Linux fan? Still a big Linux user?
I am, and mostly Fedora and CentOS. Although I did use at different times in my history other distributions. I remember using Gentoo, for example, for many years, and I gave up on it the day I came back home and I found out that they removed completely X386, so I didn't have a functional X Windows system anymore, and I need to reinstall the next windowing system. So I said, no, this is not for me. And I went to, I think, Fedora at that time.
Ah, excellent. I haven't used Gentoo. I don't want to upset any Gentoo users who are listening. I haven't used it for a little while, but I used to get a little bit upset with having to compile everything all the time. Took a while. Although you get the benefits in the speed optimization at the end of it, just before we get angry emails from Gentoo fans. So how did you get into software stuff then? Because I was reading that you used to be a neurosurgeon originally. So you were obviously into software in the early 90s. Did you study computing and then get into medicine later and then go back? How does that work?
I was doing computers since I was in middle school, so as a matter of fact, I don't remember a time where I haven't had a computer in front of me of sorts. Started with the typical microcomputers back in the day, and I don't know, remember Spectrum and Timex Sinclair and others and all the old Apples, and Commodore 64. I think I need to mention it because it's
a good.
and all the way from there, I did my medical career, but I was already working as a consultant in several companies. I think it makes it easy the fact that I rode the wave when it started. So I started using the internet when the web didn't exist. It was late 80s. It was FTP mail. If you remember that, those were the dread day where you would, instead of doing an FTP online, you would send an email with the description of what FTP commands you want to use, and the system back would send you chunks of the file compressed in different emails. And of course, as you would always lose one piece of the email, you need to go back and re-request the entire thing. And all this is over UUCP, so it would take days to go back and forth. But I really loved it. I thought that the internet had a bright future back in the day, even before the commercial entities jumped on it later on. And I think I was right.
It reminds me of my old days, too. I mean, I didn't have a Commodore 64, but I had friends that had a Commodore 64. I had the Atari 1200 and 800 before that, so same sort of era. And I remember those days that you're speaking of, dial-up modems that all went at, squeaked and squealed, and handsets with the standard. Well, back when we had standardized phones, even, where you could plug the phone into the acoustic cup, crazy stuff, huh?
A BBS, a bulletin board system, and I was part of the FidoNet network. I don't know if you remember that.
Oh, yes.
Using, started using 1200 values modems and went all the way to, I think, a 14400 or 16800, 1912, I think 19200, and that was a Zigzel modem.
Yes. Yeah, I remember the old days. Now, so I also understand, what's your role with HPCC? Are you an architect? Are you actually doing hands-on programming? Are you more of a coordinator? What's your respect to the role?
At this point, I'm the person leading the initiative, the HPCC open source initiative. In my background in the company has been in different roles. I did infrastructure for a long time, information security as well. And I kind of share still the hat with information security and this initiative. I did quite a bit of hands-on coding. I developed some software back in the day, and I said I didn't want to mention it here because I'm ashamed of my own Perl code, but like in 1999 or so, or even earlier maybe, I coded something called Flavio, which is a NetFlow analyzer piece of software, all coded in Perl, including the daemon that did the collection plus all the graphing. Of course, if you ask me to look at my own code back, I can't even read it, so...
You know, but my older code, sometimes I can't read it as well. It probably just depends on the state of mind I was in at the time. So it's nice to know that you're a fellow Perl coder from back then, though, as well. So earlier you talked about the translation of ECL? Yeah, ECL to C++. What's the choice of platform there? C++ seems like a very complex thing to try to translate stuff into.
Well, all these programmers are, I said before, compiler programmers. They were the ones coding Turbo Pascal, the compiler and the IDE and all that. So they are all C++ programmers. The platform is called coded in C++. So it made perfect sense to compile to C++. But we are not that dumb. So we use ECL, essentially has an ECL compiler that does compile to C++. But then the compilation process from C++ to machine code is done by GCC. So we try to keep a current GCC version, of course, with the platform. But that means that we don't need to take care about the specific hardware that you're trying to run it on. And as long as it's a target available on GCC, it will potentially compile and run fine. Of course, Intel and AMD x86, we don't have a current support for ARM, although we've been looking into maybe support for ARM later on, and potentially even support for LLVM, which we don't have either.
Okay, and what does it look like as a programmer to interface with this and to try to debug something with so many moving parts? I can imagine my code getting squirted across to, you know, a dozen nodes, and how do I monitor that? How do I manage that? What's my interface as a programmer to try to work out when things go wrong?
ECL provides for a very good level of abstraction, which means that when you code ECL and you essentially tell the system, I need this done. This is what I want to get done. You tell me how to do it. And it echoes back the graphical execution plan of that ECL with all the activities described on the plan. I would say that it's kind of not that hard to understand what it's trying to do. And since you can follow each one of the activities throughout this graphical plan, it's perfectly doable. The debugging on that. But of course, this applies very well when you are trying to do this for four, essentially single job at a time. But when you're trying to do the debugging on Roxy, where you may have potentially hundreds or thousands of simultaneous queries running, and those queries might be all different, essentially a lot of different ECL programs that are concurrently running, and they are exposing a parameterized interface on the front end. The problem of debugging might not be as trivial. On that case, we have also a fully fledged debugger for ECL code. So you can use our debugger as well and debug your code.
And so how often are you finding bugs in ECL translation to C++? Have you found any bugs in C++ down to machine code as well, checking this out? I'm sure you must have.
There are never bugs. They're all features. No, just kidding.
Of course. Yeah. But
we do find bugs, and we've historically found a number of bugs and sometimes some of them very pesky. I remember this is probably maybe 5 years ago or so. We were tracing a particularly pesky bug which would retrieve which could create, we do a lot of scoring. Scoring involves a lot of floating point operations across a large number of data. And many times the precision of these operations is quite high. What happened is we ended up having certain floating point operations returning a certain result on Thor and a different result on Roxy. And the difference was obviously an adjustment type of difference, but it was hard to explain why that adjustment was there. Well, traced all this back to it, all this to the fact that we were using in one case vector operations from or allowing vector operations on GCC, and on the other case we weren't. So the processor was executing them either using the SIMD instructions or using the math subsystem, and of course they would provide different results. It's all rounding results, but when you are compounding these rounding errors over time and a large number of operations, the difference can be significant.
The development effort for these projects, are you test-driven? Is it all modern buzzwordy and that sort of thing, or do you just sort of code away and hope it all runs?
We don't code away. It would be too risky, and we don't have unlimited resources. Again, it's a mythical month. Yeah, I can probably have 9 women, and they will have a baby in a single month. But that doesn't really work. So we do have a large number of regression tests that we execute automatically on a regular basis, so on a daily basis, and every morning we wake up to finding out that the code now had a regression, and we need to go back and figure out what happened. But this is good because we can quickly pinpoint the cause for the anomaly and fix it right away without waiting for a long time. We don't do a traditional waterfall type of development. We tend to focus on more of an agile type of model because it helps to have these short sprints to know exactly what you're trying to accomplish, to break the problem into small pieces and to run with those small pieces, as long as you know the big picture, of course. But yeah, we are test-driven.
And I understand that the community edition is your upstream of what your commercial edition is. How does the governance for that work? Who decides what features go into the edition?
That is a good question. And the reality is the source code, the code base for both editions is the same. This is it might sound weird, but the reality is that by the fact that we have a single code base, it is a lot easier for us to maintain the platform and to extend it and to grow on it, and also for the community to be able to leverage the platform. We do have modules that are outside of the basic platform, like advanced modules for advanced linking, fuzzy matching, specificity-based linking, for example, that are only commercial, they are only binary type of modules that run on top of the platform. But the code base for the platform, for both Thor and Roxy and the ECL compiler and the ECL optimizer and the graphic action plans and the Eclipse ID module and the ECL ID, these are all open source and freely available components. And they have a single code base. We started with two different code bases. We tried that, and it was really, really hard to maintain. And at some point, we said the effort is really not worth it. It's better to have a single code base and be honest with ourselves and with the community. We have the same code base. Let's work on it, and let's try to do the best for all of us. Of course, things that are not required for normal operations or for normal use of the platform and are advanced capabilities, well, those could go in binary modules that you can add later on and buy them or whatever.
So does anyone outside your immediate project have commit bits then, or is it all just basically done by forking and pulling it in?
We do have. We are running, and I think I hinted this before, we are running the project in GitHub, which, by the way, Git is a very nice source control system. Not that we need to get into the debate of centralized versus distributed control systems now. But we used to use a centralized version control system before, and moving to Git was a significant change, and I would say even disruption initially, to our development process. But it helped a lot. We have developers in different countries and different locations, and the fact that you can very easily do your fork and then a pull request and get the code back into the main trunks, it makes things a lot easier. So we do have external contributors. We did have some contributions for different things, code, documentation, use cases. And of course, we have a ton of, a number of bug reports and feature requests that we try to work out as we can. But as in any other open source project that has been closed source before, there is a first period of time where you need to put a lot of effort in essentially helping the community. You're going to get a lot more requests than contributions. And then the thing will balance itself. Eventually, over time, there will be more contributions, and the requests and the contributions will essentially balance each other.
Okay, so I think I heard that there's some people outside your group. How many people are in the group that you're closely associated with then?
Within LexisNexis, working on the platform, there are about 50 people or so. Outside of LexisNexis, the community obviously is a lot larger. I haven't counted in the forums, but there are potentially hundreds of them, and we have forums, mailing lists, and other vehicles for communication with them. And there are several contributors there. We had contributions on C++ code as extensions for the platform, and some on the scripts or tools around deployment. We had a lot of significant amount of ECL code contributions as well. And of course, documentation and use cases and samples also come quite frequently. That helps a lot, because since we are trying to make sure that other people look at the platform, even if they don't think that they have a problem that will fit the platform, having other use cases that might be similar to what they are doing is always beneficial.
Are you at the point yet where you're having your own conventions or user groups for this?
We haven't done any of those face-to-face user groups. We do have some IRC discussions and obviously some phone calls sometimes are extended outside of the community. We have a few community key people that have been contributing. For example, there's a person that contributed the integration with a machine learning, C++ machine learning library. They built about 100,000 lines of C++ or machine learning libraries of with different capabilities, and they did integration for HPCC, essentially all the ECL wrappers, so you can call all these functions from within ECL. So, these people are in the community, and they are quite active, so we have frequent calls and we touch base very regularly. Now, we haven't done a face-to-face convention. We organized and orchestrating a convention that will essentially gather hundreds of people. It's not an easy challenge. So we'll probably do that something like that next year, but we haven't got around to doing it.
Could I build the next Google with this? Is there enough horizontal scaling that I could have enough like a huge search engine with this?
Yeah, of course. You could build your own Google. We do a lot of processing on our own of unstructured data, and that includes web data. One of the nice examples on the HPC Systems portal is a PageRank example on Wikipedia. Essentially takes all the Wikipedia pages, I don't remember now the number, but it's a couple million or so, and builds all the edges across them, and then does the iterative processing of the page rank, which, by the way, sometimes people are confused because they think that page rank refers to the web pages, and in reality it refers to the name of the man that created page rank, who happened to be one of the founders for Google. So we should call it ECL rank, if you want.
Cool. And so that's an example of the biggest this thing could probably go, be another Google sensor. What's the smallest that this would make sense for? I mean, can I put this all just in one box and run the entire system? And how little data would make sense to use this rather than a traditional database system?
Yeah, you can really use it on a single box. We do very frequently meetups. And when I go and present, I take normally my own HPCC in just a virtual machine. I take normally 3 or 4 nodes, and this is to demonstrate how data flows on a distributed system. Even it's a pseudo-distributed because it's running on my laptop, and the nodes are in the same hard drive. But it shows how the platform can scale from very, very tiny, just 2 or 3 little virtual nodes, or just 1 virtual node, up to hundreds of nodes. And even I can reuse the exact same ECL code. So you can go very little, and if you have the needs to scale and add more nodes, you can scale and add more nodes. And scalability is mostly linear. So you add more nodes, and you get a factor of like 0.9 something on scalability, which is very good.
Now, most of your money to fund this is because you're selling this service, LexisNexis is selling the service. Are you getting also a revenue stream from support of this directly, or the add-on features of the commercial edition?
Yes, we are. We are providing commercial support, and we have an enterprise license as well for those companies that require the open source indemnity that we all learn from SEO. We provide also support, our own support. So if you want to get support from us, from LexisNexis, the enterprise distribution or enterprise edition is what you want to buy. If you are fine with community support or support from a third party, then you can use the open source edition and use the third party support.
Very good, very good. All right, we're almost out of time. Is there anything I haven't asked you that you want to make sure our audience is...
I think the most important thing is the platform is open source. All of it is there. There is nothing limiting on the open source side. And the most important thing is we accept contributions. We welcome contributions. We would like to have more contributions. So anything that people can contribute to it, and this doesn't need to be code. If you are not a coder, you can write documentation. You can write a sample case. You can help us with whatever. Anything that can help the initiative, it will be very welcome by us.
Very good. Well, it's been a pleasure chatting with you about your project, and good luck to you in future events.
Thank you very much, Randall.
Very good. That was Dr. Flavio Villanostri. Hope I pronounced that correctly. Dan, what'd you think?
I thought it was fascinating. A really, really interesting guest. A great speaker. I've got to confess, big data isn't an area that I know a hell of a lot about, but it seems like this is a really interesting solution. And I think one of the fears that that I had looking at it, and maybe you did as well, was the kind of an open core element to it. But he reassured me there when he was saying what we want is contribution from people and interaction and so on. It seems like they're actually doing it for the right reasons, which is great.
Yeah, I'm not a big expert on big data either. Although I'm learning. I hear it all around me as the new buzzword, the new thing to learn about. So I'm probably going to have to study up more on this as well. To understand, but it sounds like a really solid project with and works well for this particular space. And I know we've had some other big data people on, I guess about 6 months or a year ago. Some of the Red Hat guys or whatever probably provided some of the. But yeah, this is fascinating guy to talk to. I always like talking to the old fogies like me, you know, that started with the acoustic coupled modem and the little 6502 based machines, and it's. It always takes me back. I'm getting now for, God, 40 years, so I guess it's not hard to have run into other people who have also been around for the same amount of time.
I mean, I don't quite remember that far back, I'd just like to point out. But I know what you mean. Yeah, it's fascinating. I think we could have talked about retro computing for a long time. But, I mean, yeah, sticking to the actual, I suppose, the point of it. I think, yeah, as you say, big data is really kind of taking off because there's so much data being accumulated over the years that it's not surprising that now we're reaching, you know, we've had computers for decades and decades now, that there's so much data around that needs to be collated and analyzed and all the rest of it. I suppose, you know, it's a simple name, but it just is big data, isn't it, really? Not what else to say.
Well, we're certainly tackling a lot of problems now that we couldn't have even conceived of a few years ago. I mean, to look at the search, the amount of pages that are searched when you type search into Google or Bing or something, and how quickly it responds, and how you got to believe there's, you know, thousands of nodes are each handling a little part of your query somehow, and how does it all get brought together? It's great that we have four leading companies like Google and those guys actually working on some of these problems and opening up some of the technologies like Hadoop and things like that, so that we have a basis to start from. And companies like HPCC here, this project, making it also available to us in a totally usable form. So, it's hard. Again, if you would have asked me at any point during my career, what do you see 5 years out? I could never have predicted any 5-year window. And I don't know if that's the same for you, Dan, but it just changes so much. So I have no idea where this is going to go.
Yeah, I think it's really difficult to predict where things are going to go. But I think if we were able to do that, we'd go and buy lottery tickets and other things, and we'd all be set for life. But it is difficult. I think one of the interesting parts of it for me was the language that they've created, this ECL language. Of their own, which sounds really fascinating. And I was curious to know the kind of learning curve and the relationship between it and something like SQL, which I've used before. There's a lot of SQL is a very old language, and there's a lot of people trying to get away from it now. There's the whole NoSQL movement, and there's all these different things going on. So it might be interesting. I might have a look at ECL and give it a whirl.
Yeah. Well, there is one thing we can predict about what's coming up in the future, and that's our upcoming guests. So let me check the list here and see what's going on. We have a mystery guest for next week, which just means I still have it open and hope I can fill it before next week. But the week following, we're going to do the show that we had to cancel last week, which is KVM. Apparently, they weren't aware of the fact that it was a holiday for them. So they had to say, nope, we can't be on the show. Sorry, last minute. But we'll put on a couple weeks from now. Just add to the list since we last chatted, Bayrock, which is embedded Linux systems. Hopefully, Dan, you could be on that show and talk about that. The chatbot. Still on there. One we hope we had for the pirate show, but we didn't get it. We have still on the list Poodle, which is the cutest name I've ever heard for an open source project. That's an online translation management tool with translation interface. Just add to the schedule immediately following that for good comparison, we have Zenata, which is also an online translation management tool with a translation interface. So they'll be able to contrast and compare themselves with Poodle, which had just been the previous week. Also, just added to the schedule, a couple more shows, Cake PHP. It's a big web framework that I know a lot of you PHP people out there use for building your websites. And Yezod, which is also a web framework, but written in Haskell. We've had a couple of projects on Haskell in the show in the past, and it'll be nice to see what they're doing with Haskell for their web interface. A lot more on the short list. If you go to twit.tv/floss, you're going to see the big spreadsheet linked from there, and you can see who I'm be talking to or who I should be talking to. I'm trying to send out emails as often as I can. You can follow us at Floss Weekly on Google+ for the announcements of when the shows are coming up. You can also follow us on Floss Weekly on Eidetica and Twitter for those timely announcements as well. We have a live chat room. We took a couple of questions from the chat room today. It's at live.twit.tv. We tape at 8:30 a.m. Pacific time on Wednesdays, typically, except when the shows are canceled. Sorry about that. You can follow me at Merlyn, M-E-R-L-Y-N. It's on Twitter. And I'm also L. Schwartz on Google+. Try to post about 4 or 5 interesting things there every day. I'm currently in New Orleans for another few more days, which is why my eyes are a little glazy today and why my bandwidth is horrible. I'm back to Southern California again for another couple weeks, and then I'm on my big next cruise going out of Genoa around to Greece and Israel and Rome. So it's going to be a nice, fun little trip for me there. Dan, where can we find you?
Yeah, the best place is always danlynch.org. Thankfully, John's put it at the bottom of the screen there for everyone who's watching. But that's the best place to go. I post music, technical articles about completely unrelated things like football or soccer, as you guys like to call it, over there. All kinds of stuff. Obviously, don't forget to check out Linux Outlaws, which you can find at sixgun.org/Linux Outlaws. It's a weekly show about Linux and open source, free software, all that kind of stuff. We talk a lot about Android and other things, so you can find us there. And just keep an eye on that. If you want to find me on Twitter or Google+ or any of those places, have a look at danlynch.org. All the links are there. And the username is MethodDan on most of those sites. So yeah, come along and say hello, and let's all be friends.
Very good, Dan, and thank you again for being the wonderful co-host for this week's show. I appreciate it every time, especially your Linux background, helping me out when I'm a little gappy on that.
No problem. It's always a pleasure, and I'll see you again soon.
I'm sure you will. Very good, and we'll see you all again next time on Floss Weekly.